Welcome to the UK and World News Channel on Orbio, powered by Audio Boom. In this show, after conflicting reports yesterday, it's now been confirmed that the suspected ringleader of the Paris attacks, Abdelhamid Aboud, was among those killed in a French police raid on Wednesday. Junior doctors in the UK have voted to strike by a massive majority. We find out what that means. And on the day the last Hunger Games movie hits cinemas, Donald Sutherland, who plays Jon Snow, says this is just the beginning. First, the latest global headlines from the AP newsroom.
AP Radio News. I'm Rita Foley. They know he's dead, but they don't know exactly how he died. The alleged mastermind of the Paris terror attacks was killed during a police raid at a suburban apartment. Authorities there are now confirming this. AP correspondent Thomas Adamson is in Paris.
The Paris prosecutor has said that Abdelhamid Aboud has been killed in the Wednesday morning police raid. The prosecutor's office said that the suspected mastermind's body was found in an apartment building in the Saint-Denis suburb of Paris. It said that the body was identified based on what it called skin samples.
The only other person killed during the raid was a woman who is believed to have detonated a suicide vest. Three police officials tell us she was Abaoud's cousin. The NYPD has seen that newly released Islamic State group video showing images of Times Square. And with just a week to go before the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade in New York, Deputy Police Commissioner and terrorism expert John Miller says what the militants are doing is pretty obvious.
One thing that ISIS understands almost better than terrorism is marketing. What you saw last night was a commercial. It's meant to sell a product. The product is fear. Could it happen here? Of course it could, but that's because it could happen anywhere.
President Obama says he sees no reason that the Paris terror attack should derail his promise to close Gitmo. He's promising to work meticulously, as he puts it, with Congress to try to close the Guantanamo Bay prison. A court hearing today in Delaware for a White House Secret Service officer charged with trying to solicit a 14-year-old girl for sex. Lee Robert Moore is due to appear today at a hearing where prosecutors will ask that he be held in custody until his trial. Fewer of us applied for unemployment last week. This is AP Radio News. Today we'll hear the leading Democratic candidates explain their strategy for fighting Islamic State militants. AP correspondent Diane Kaplan.
Hillary Clinton is focusing on homeland security and the role of U.S. leadership around the globe as she speaks in New York, while Bernie Sanders will talk about the Paris attacks and how the world community can defeat the Islamic State in remarks at Georgetown University. Both say the extremist group must be defeated, but they take different approaches. Clinton wants to set up a no-fly zone over northern Syria, something Sanders opposes. He's leaving the door open to U.S. partnerships with Iran and Russia. They agree on a couple of points. They oppose a large-scale ground combat operation, and neither is willing to call the fight a war against radical Islamic terrorists. I'm Diane Kaplan.
Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump doesn't think the U.S. should allow any immigrant refugees into this country at the moment, and he's questioning calls by rivals Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz to give preference to Christian refugees. Rita Foley, AP Radio News.
After conflicting reports yesterday, it's now been confirmed that the suspected ringleader of the Paris attacks, Abdelhamid Aboud, was among those killed in a French police raid on Wednesday. Kushla Norma, Audio Boom reporter, has the story.
The Paris prosecutor says the suspected ringleader of the Paris attacks, Abdelhamid Aboud, has been identified as one of those killed in a police raid yesterday. The BBC says Aboud's body was riddled with bullets and shrapnel. The 27-year-old Belgian of Moroccan origin was identified by his fingerprints. A woman, who French media say was Aboud's cousin, blew herself up during the raid.
Now, Asa Bennett, the assistant comment editor at The Telegraph, joins Share Radio to discuss the news that junior doctors have voted for a three-day strike with a 98% majority.
As we heard earlier in the news, junior doctors in England have overwhelmingly voted in favour of going on strike in their dispute with ministers over a new contract. The first walkout is scheduled for December the 1st. For his assessment of the implications, I'm joined on the line by Asa Bennett, assistant comment editor at The Telegraph. Asa, thanks for being with us here on Share Radio.
Pleasure.
So, no surprise in the vote. It was expected it would be a vote for. What happens next? Is ACAS going to be involved, the Advisory Conciliation and Arbitration Service?
Well, the BMA has responded to this, and Jeremy Hunt, of course, has refused the idea of conciliatory talks with ACAS. So it seems to be, you know, on the collision course now, with junior doctors voting very much overwhelmingly to strike. And indeed, it was by a margin that you wouldn't get in a sort of RMT ballot, I'd say that. And it was 98% of junior doctors on a sort of quite hefty turnout as well, something approximately 70% off the top of my head. But so as a result, we then see 3 days of strike action on the cards. The first day, 1st of December, it will be emergency care only for 24 hours, and then it will be a full walkout from December the 8th and December the 16th. Not from, but on those 2 days in particular. So as a result, this sort of junior contracts dispute that has definitely raged for the past few weeks, it's going to finally rear its head, I guess. And it's peculiar, after you see this. Some may have appealed to moderate doctors to, fight the militants, but definitely they seem to be alarmed, and maybe they've given in to the scaremongering from the BMA, and so, they probably would appreciate that. It's now a big PR campaign going on in this sense about, yes, what will happen to the health system when this happens. Because the Department of Health and those sort of types, they would say that it's putting patients at risk. And the Chief Medical Officer has said this, the Patients Association has said this. And so there is definitely a sort of alarm about the prospect. And yet, obviously, the BMA is insisting that, don't worry, the NHS can cope and it's their responsibility to, pick up the slack. So it's definitely going to be a sort of nail-biter as we approach strike day.
The screaming question in my head, and probably also widespread among the public, particularly those that have got operations coming up, is how on earth has it come to this? Is it, I wonder, down to poor communications? Did the junior doctors, were they fully informed of what they were voting on? There also seemed to be confused figures about what sort of rises were involved and what sort of work patterns were involved. It does seem to be down to poor communication.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of sort of he said, she said, and every part is not too clear, I'll admit, given that first off, the doctors aren't known for being militant, let's make that clear, in that the last time they properly took industrial action was 1975. And so when you look at this time, there's a bit of a dispute going on about junior contracts, and it's a sort of long-running sore. The contract's been built on terms and conditions that were formed in the 90s, and they've tried to update this now. And the BMA, there's been a bit of sulking going on about this concept of, what are out-of-hours work, what is appropriate normal hours of pay. And the headline figure that the Department of Health say is that junior doctors will get a pay rise of 11%, but then they sort of say quietly under their breath, if they're working normal hours. And yet some people tend to be working sort of odd sorts of times. And so there is this mild paradox where the Department of Health has been trying to do it on the cheap, in a sense of having a 7-day NHS with everyone being there, all throughout, just as good quality. Trouble is that costs.
As the epic Hunger Games saga draws to an end, with Mockingjay Part 2 in cinemas from Thursday, Donald Sutherland, who plays Jon Snow, tells Audioboom's Entertainment News Channel that this is just the beginning.
I don't think of it as coming to an end. I think of it as just beginning, because it was designed as a catalyst to get young people out of their chairs and organize them politically, to activate them, to explain to them, to exemplify for them that the world as they know it is going to end.
And, I mean, it has inspired a nation. It's Generation K. It must be incredible to be a part of that and to inspire young people.
Well, it's why I was involved in it. I just wanted to be, to have, I'm 80 years old, to have on my gravestone, he was in Hunger Games. Because I hope that people can look back in their lives and say it was because of this movie. I can look back and say it was because of Stanley Kubrick's Paths of Glory that I became politicized.
And discussing the latest news, here is the Pacey The Briefing from London's Midori House at Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 19th of November 2015 on Monocle 24. and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up in today's programme, France's Prime Minister warns of the dangers of a chemical attack.
Il ne faut aujourd'hui rien exclure. Nous l'évoquions
hier. We can't exclude anything today, and I say this with all the precaution it calls for. But we know it, we have it in mind. There can be the risk of chemical and biological weapons. We'll bring you all the latest from Paris. Then we look at the latest issue of Islamic State's monthly English magazine and what it has to say about both the attacks on Paris and the downed Russian jet. Plus, $2 billion earmarked for the fight against Boko Haram is stolen from the Nigerian government. And the prime suspect, the country's former security advisor. And later in the show, we'll meet an artist taking his work quite literally to new heights at Mount Everest. All that and more besides ahead on The Briefing with me, Tom Edwards. A very busy show in prospect this Thursday lunchtime here in London. Let's start, though, with a look through some front pages from across the Americas. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco joins me in Studio One. Faye, where should we start?
Let's start at the Los Angeles Times, Tone. Of course, Paris coverage is still everywhere, but the headline, actually, of the paper today is that the mayor of L.A., Eric Garcetti, he ruled out to a state of emergency for the homeless people in L.A. because El Nino storm is apparently going to reach California in January, and everybody's worried about that. And Los Angeles, of course, has a huge problem with homeless people. They have around 26,000. Actually, it's expected to be more. But he said there is no need for that. That's quite interesting. I'm sure it's going to cause quite a lot of controversy in the city.
Hugely controversial, one imagines. Where next, Fernando? What about the New York Times?
Let's go to the New York Times. Again, they have a very interesting story about the rise of ISIS. You know, is one of those kind of long-form pieces of the New York Times I recommend everyone to read. And also, they have interesting business stories about TV shows in America. Apparently, major networks, they're afraid to cancel a TV show like they used to do after three or four series. And the reason because of that, now a lot of viewers are watching series on delayed viewing. So you don't know if the series is doing well on the first week or not, because people can catch up a bit later. So they have to be a bit more cautious with that.
Once again, how these new models are changing people's viewing habits. Where next, Fernando? What about La Nación? Let's head south.
Let's end of La Nación, Argentina election this Sunday. And of course, La Nación has an interview, a final interview of Mauricio Macri from the opposition party and Daniel Scioli. And Mauricio Macri again saying he's going to do everything different from the Kirchner model. And Scioli saying, I'll do different, but not so different.
Not so different. Any sense who's going to win? Are they hedging their bets a little?
I would say probably Macri for now, but let's see until Monday.
Putting Fernando on the spot there. Fernando Augusto Pacheco with the headlines from across the Americas. Thanks for joining us on The Briefing. Let's look at business next. Here to tell us what's making the headlines there is Neira Chaich from Bloomberg TV. Neira, let's talk about the Fed first of all.
Yeah, so we got the minutes from the US Federal Reserve's last meeting, the one at the end of October. We got those yesterday. And basically, the way markets seem to be interpreting them is that we're expecting a dovish hike. Now, let me explain. The minutes basically kept December very much kind of in the picture as the time when we could see the Fed raise rates for the first time since 2006. Traders are still pricing in a 66% probability of a rate hike in December. But what the Fed also said is that after that, there would be a gradual pace of tightening. That's where the sort of dovish element comes in. But overall, it seems that people are looking at this and thinking, okay, the US economy, the world's biggest, maybe it is strong enough for the Fed to start raising rates. And what's more is that these minutes cover a meeting which actually happened before the last set of jobs numbers. And those jobs numbers were the highest this year and, you know, better than expected.
Neira, let's talk a little bit about, some big pharma names as well. Pfizer, Allergan, tell us why these names are in the frame today.
Well, according to people familiar with the matter, Pfizer's in advanced talks to buy Allergan, which is the maker of Botox, to buy it for as much as $380 per share, which would value Allergan at as high as $150 billion. Now, if this goes ahead, Tom, it would be the biggest pharma deal ever. ever. It would also be the biggest deal in any industry this year. And this year for pharma and biotech has already been a bumper year, already surpassing the record that was hit last year in terms of the value of deals. Now, of course, what Pfizer has to get out of this is that it could strengthen its position in brand name drugs as opposed to older or generic drugs. Also, it would allow it to achieve what's known as a tax inversion. That's when US companies buy companies abroad. In this case, Allergan has its legal domicile in Dublin, and they do that for tax purposes. Now, we know that last year the US Treasury really cracked down on this. In fact, yesterday we got a letter, not we, but I mean the US Treasury sent a letter saying it's reviewing ways to address overseas acquisitions, and it plans to issue guidance later this week. Now, this is important. It could be the sticking point because although the Treasury can't actually stop a tax inversion taking place, what it can do is reduce the economic benefits of a deal like that. And that might mean that Pfizer might not want to pay as much for Allergan. You know, it reduces the likelihood of the deal actually going ahead, because what we saw last year when the US Treasury was proposing to crack down on tax inversions, we, for example, saw AbbVie dropping a $52 billion purchase of Shire. So that is a big sticking point at the moment. But as I say, they're in advanced talks, Pfizer and Allergan, according to the people familiar. And these people say the companies could announce an agreement as soon as Monday.
One to watch, potentially a huge deal in the offing. Naira Chayic from Bloomberg TV, thanks very much for joining us, as ever, here on The Briefing. Here in London, but to Paris we head next. France's Prime Minister is warning there's a risk of chemical attacks. Now, this comes as politicians debate extending state of emergency measures for an additional 3 months. Police are still looking for suspects connected to Friday's attacks on the French capital, and it remains unclear whether the suspected organiser of the shootings and blasts on Friday was killed in Wednesday's raid in the suburb of Saint-Denis. Next week, President Francois Hollande will meet with his US counterpart Barack Obama, then a few days later with Russia's Vladimir Putin to discuss wider cooperation in the fight against Islamic State. Well, joining us for more is Christine Ocran, former COO of France 24 and political commentator and good friend of Monocle 24. Christine, thanks for being on The Briefing. Let me start maybe to ask you by looking back over, well, an extraordinary week, a tumultuous week. Is there any sense there that the dust is settling now? There's still so much uncertainty on the streets of Paris. What's your response now as we are almost a week on?
Well, how could I put it? The story is not over. And as you said, there are still many uncertainties. The major one, of course, being where is actually the guy who has probably been the brain and the coordinator, Abdelhamid Abaoud, where is he? There was that massive assault the night before last, where seven jihadists were either taken prisoners or killed. He was not among them. So that's the major uncertainty, that Abaoud is still on the run. Second, you have all the measures which the government keeps announcing. One is that the police will be allowed to keep their weapons even when they are out of service. So this is a major request of the police ever since the Charlie Hebdo events back in January. That you know, the unions felt that they were not equipped, not so much materially as indeed legally, to face such danger. There's now talk about indeed extending the state of emergency for 3 months. And Manuel Valls, who's been speaking in Parliament this very morning, now has always gives an idea that things could indeed get worse. It's very interesting in political terms that our politicians in our democracies, when such a catastrophe happens, they try to react as best as they can, and they say, well, you know, now things are over, things is in control. But in this particular case, with, of course, the accusation that the French government did not take enough measures after the Charlie Hebdo events, well, this time around, the Prime Minister now says, well, beware, there might even be chemical attacks.
Christine, can I just ask you, we spoke back in January following the Charlie Hebdo attacks, and I know you knew people who were involved in that, some of the people who lost their lives as well, and we talked about the response both of Paris and of France more broadly, and we talked about this idea about things going back to normal, people remaining defiant, moving on with their lives. I sense, I don't know, from what you're saying now, that this attack, as many have been suggesting, does change things in a more profound way, even than what we saw in January. Maybe not just the political ramifications or changes to states of emergency or what the police are entitled to do, but something more fundamental even than that. Do you think that might be the case? Are you fearful that that could change France for the worst? What do you think when you look ahead now?
Well, I'm very struck by the resilience of the people. And the fact that there was obviously, and there still is, that enormous trauma, but at the same time, and especially among that generation which was really the target, you know, the young people, the people who would live and work in that part of Paris, which is the trendy part, the soccer game and the concert hall and these restaurants in that particular area, they say, you know, the very day, on Saturday, they went back and said, let's go back to the cafes and sip our wine and let's show that we are determined that our way of life will not change and that we don't feel that we are the victims or that we have lost that fight. And I think that determination is very palpable indeed.
Christine Ocron, former CEO of France 24, a political commentator, friend of Monocle 24, thank you so much for speaking to us here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. It is 13 minutes past 12 here in London, 7:13 a.m. in Washington, D.C. Now, the cover of the Islamic States magazine Dabiq shows Paris first responders attending Friday's attacks that we've just been hearing about, with the two-word title, Just Terror. Among the pages of the English language title are photographs of an improvised explosive device made out of a can of pop that the magazine claims took down the Russian jet plane over Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, killing all 224 people on board. The magazine speaks of both this attack and of Paris, claiming them both as acts of justice, in their words. Well, joining us now is Charlie Winter, Senior Research Associate at GSU's Transcultural Conflict and Violence Initiative. Charlie, thanks for being with us on The Briefing. I don't know, it's always tricky to sort of look through these sorts of publications, particularly at a time like this, but having done so grimly, what do you glean from the content? Exactly what one would have expected? Anything that struck you particularly?
I think it's exactly what one would have expected. It's not at all different in any way from any of the other issues of Dabiq that have come out. I do kind of think that this magazine is as much made for journalists and the wider world as it is for supporters themselves. I mean, the amount of information in there about Paris and the Sinai bomb, of course, as well as other attacks. I mean, they kind of put in little claims here and there for other attacks in Israel-Palestine as well, and also talk at length about setting up shop in Bangladesh. So it's about a projection of power, and it's meant to inspire followers, of course, but also they know full well that when they, for example, slip in an article allegedly penned by John Cantley, that it will be everywhere, that every newspaper will report on Darbuk in some respect.
You talk about it's maybe being, you know, more for journalists as much as anything else, and there's been a lot of discussion, well, throughout the lifespan so far of IS, actually, about their media savvy, if we want to call it that. What do we know? I mean, do we know anything, indeed, about how this publication is actually put together, about the kinds of people and the processes that they're going through? They seem able to respond very quickly to events. How professional an operation is it?
So it's put together by Al Hayat Media Centre, which is Islamic State's kind of foreign language media centre. Usually features foreign fighters, but often doesn't as well. Now, there's very little that we can really see from the outside of what Islamic State's media infrastructure looks like. They're very, very secretive about it. We don't know who is running things from the top. We don't know how they get all this data into one place before publishing it. It's a very, very secretive option, very secretive side of the organisation, and something which is deliberately opaque. But yes, they do respond very quickly. Yes, they do it very professionally. I mean, having translated a lot of Arabic into English myself, it's not easy to do it in a way which is as well done here. And they're not only translating it from Arabic to English, but they're translating from Bangla to Arabic to English, or Russian to Arabic to English. It's a very concerted, well-organized operation. And this is what we see with a lot of Islamic State's media operations in general. It's very well organized. They are investing a huge amount of time into their brand, and their brand is central to their ability to succeed. So it makes sense.
Just on that point, I guess a lot of your time is spent considering this from a strategic viewpoint. Is it a miscalculation to, I don't know, make these, to produce these kinds of titles, to produce, as you said, to work so hard on the brand? Do you think it risks, you know, garnering a more sort of vociferous response, if you like, from the West when it's put into frames of reference that people can understand? Or do you think that, you know, as you mentioned, it's fundamental to their very raison d'etre to keep these sorts of, you know, products and stuff coming out?
First and foremost, Islamic State is a terrorist organisation. It has jihadist aims, global jihadist aims. And while it does say it's a state and it has many of the things that look like a state, its key reason for doing all of this is just so it can prolong its ideological existence. So while it may certainly provoke a more vociferous response from the West, for example, military escalation, we've already seen that from the French, and there'll be likely a lot more in the coming days and weeks, that is actually good for the organisation ideologically. It lends it credibility among global jihadists. These are the guys that Islamic State wants to impress. None of what it does is mistaken. They have a strategy behind all of their actions. Paris, while it looked like it was just wholesale massacre of civilians, every bullet that they were firing, they knew that this was going to enrage people, they knew it was going to polarise societies, and they knew that this would end up helping the overall ideological direction of Islamic State. So yes, vociferous response will come because of this kind of thing, but that's desired.
Charlie, very briefly, a lot of people have said, look, you know, obviously there's questions about whether it's airstrikes, boots on the ground, how you actually tackle IS at root. A lot of people also said, well, hang on, if you consider these ideas about brand, if you consider these talk discussions about ideology, there needs to be, I don't know, almost a PR offensive as well. Is that mistaken if people in the West say that? Do you think it needs to be viewed as a terrorist organisation and dealt with militarily? Or is there a case for saying that we need to up our own game in the PR side of things?
We absolutely do. I think it's really critically important that not only in kind of military information operations, psyops, that kind of thing, but also just from a kind of more broad across society point of view, people need to engage with this space, because Islamic State, they know what they're doing, and they're doing it very, very well. But they are still, I mean, in terms of numbers, they're not a very effective social movement. They are nowhere near a mass movement. And there are a lot more of us than there are of them, a lot more people who hate IS than there are people who love it. And it's all about redirecting this asymmetry of passion, where you have people who are very much against Islamic State, but they don't really want to engage in the space. That's seen as something that governments can do and should do, and we can leave it to them. But governments, while they do have a role in this, they're hopeless when it comes to actually basically credibly challenging what Islamic State is trying to say. And every time they do, Islamic State just laugh at them. So it's what we need to do is kind of restructure, reappraise our entire information architecture surrounding the kind of marketing war on IS. It's really important that we do that.
Fascinating stuff. Charlie Winter, Senior Research Associate at GSU's Transcultural Conflict and Violence Initiative. Thanks very much for being with us here on The Briefing. Thank you.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
De Nova York, de Toronto, de Londres, de Zurich.
Ik Singapur. Ik Toronto.
Nach Paris, nach München, nach Berlin, nach Frankfurt.
New York, Toronto, London, Zurich, Istanbul, Hong Kong, Tokyo.
Tout استمعونا الى Monocle 24
diffusé autour du monde 24h sur 24.
You're tuned to Monocle 24.
12:20 here in London. Now, when Sambo Dasuki left his job in the Nigerian government, he left with a fair bit more than a rogue stapler from the stationery cupboard. It's alleged the former security advisor to former President Goodluck Jonathan stole $2 billion from government coffers. Nigeria's President Muhammad Buhari says the money was supposed to pay for helicopters, fighter jets and ammunition in the fight against Boko Haram, and has ordered the arrest of Dasuki. Well, joining us now in the studio is James Schneider, senior correspondent for New African Magazine. James, I fear that we've had these sorts of conversations rather too often for most people's likings before. What do we know about Sambo Dasuki in this particular case? What details are clear at this moment?
So Sambo Dasuki was national security advisor from 2012 until the change in June. And he is meant to have been in charge of procurement and was meant to have been given or have overseen rather a lot of money, which is which it's been alleged has gone missing. When Buhari came in earlier this year, he set up a sort of commission of inquiry to look into money that had appeared to have gone missing in arms procurement and basically through the army in the fight against Boko Haram. It's frequently claimed by frontline soldiers that they don't have gear, that they're meant to be paid and the money doesn't come, that they're meant to have all this great equipment and which, but they don't have it. And so there've long been allegations that there's been serious corruption at the high level. So there's been this this commission of inquiry. They've had their interim report, which has fingered Dasuki and a few other key players, and he's now been arrested.
What does this mean then, in exactly that frontline fight that you're mentioning there against Boko Haram? Because presumably, if it's as much as $2 billion, that is going to leave, I mean, I don't know what, as a percentage of the available spend to bolster that fight that represents, one would imagine, significant. What does it actually mean? How hamstrung could the broader attempts to tackle this insurgency be by the loss of these funds in particular?
To put it in context, $2 billion would be around about a third or maybe more than a third of Nigeria's overall security spending. So it's a substantial amount of money. And it has been reported that some soldiers have said that their equipment has got better since Buhari came in. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's down to him, because the previous government claim that, well, that stuff that they bought towards the end. And it is true that right at the end of Jonathan's administration, they did start getting a bit more serious with Boko Haram and clearing them out of several towns. Dasuki's role is interesting, how he's been singled out, because he was the one that pretty much postponed the elections in February, which cast doubt on the whole electoral process and whether Buhari, if he won, would be allowed to take over. And he has a long history with Buhari. It's alleged that he was one of the four majors who came and removed Buhari from power when Buhari was last in power in a coup in 1985. So they've got history together.
I guess there's two things I'd like to ask you about. One is, what does this tell us about the state of corruption, or the tackling of corruption, arrival of more transparency in government in Nigeria between the Goodluck Jonathan and Buhari administration, if anything indeed has changed? And secondly, what are the mechanics of how somebody actually manages to siphon off, as you say, potentially a third of the national security spend? I mean, it would seem improbable. What are the developments on those two fronts?
So there's good news and bad news on the anti-corruption front. The good news is that there are investigations that are ongoing. The new government is clearly trying to tackle the issue. It's trying to investigate things that happened in the previous administration. This is very good. It's very high profile. This should stop people trying things on quite so much. The possible downside, though, is about the process. So some of the allegations, for example, came out on Buhari's presidential Twitter account, and he made a statement calling for the arrest. And some people have gone, well, actually, in due process, the president doesn't call for the arrest of the National Security Advisor, or former National Security Advisor. So positive, but there's some process questions. Then on how you'd actually do it, ministry accounts and then like parastatal accounts and military accounts used to, they all used to be allowed to have them in private banks. Mm. So you would have literally, you know, possibly thousands of bank accounts all over the place. Very, very difficult to monitor. Very, very, very easy to siphon off bits of money. $2 billion is huge. I mean, that it would be, it would need more than a couple of rogue bank accounts. But one of the things that the government, the new government has tried to do is make it illegal to have, for any government entity to have a private bank account. They all have to be logged in one bank account at the central bank, which should provide a lot more transparency.
James Schneider, senior correspondent with New African Magazine, thanks very much for being with us here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. It is exactly 26 minutes past the hour, finally, on today's show. Mount Everest isn't known for its art scene, but a new artist in residence is on his way to base camp. The British artist, Derek Elland, is getting ready to pack his bags to document the artistic side of climbing season. And I'm delighted to say he joins us now from, well, not from Everest, but from Cumbria. Derek, good to speak with you. Tell me, is this your first visit to Everest? And what, whether it is or isn't, are you hoping to accomplish with this artist-in-residence position?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Yeah, it's my first time. It'll be my first time to Everest and my first time to Nepal. What I hope to achieve is similar to the work I did in Afghanistan in 2011, when I was a war artist out there, and I spent a month on the front line. And instead of carrying paints and brushes and easels, I carried hundreds of postcards, and I asked everyone I met, soldiers and civilians and Afghan and Western, what it was like to be there, what was it like to be human on the front line. And I collated about 600 of these stories from everyone I met in Big Brother style diary rooms on the front line.
Well, Derek, it's interesting. I mean, clearly, you know, the extremes, whether it's environmental or experiential, can deliver lots of interesting creativity, lots of interesting stories. Is that something that, as an artist, appeals to you? Because, you know, war artists in Afghanistan documenting the extremes of Everest, these are very challenging environments. Some people must say to you must be mad to tackle these sorts of projects.
Yeah, I think people have said that. But I am interested in the human spirit and what it is like to be human in difficult circumstances. So as well as these projects, I've also worked with people with dementia, with the Alzheimer's Society, and I've also worked with people who've been flooded out of their homes. So I guess, you know, wherever we are under some kind of stress and duress, be it dangerous or difficult or just very, very demanding, what does it feel like to be in that place? And what I found is that as well as photographing people and filming people in that situation, to gather their intimate thoughts and their honest thoughts in handwriting there and then, typically on a postcard or a post-it note, really works in revealing something that a camera or a typed-up piece of text just can't reveal.
No, absolutely. Derek, let me ask you about your own preparations then, because presumably whether it's going to a war zone or in this case one of the, you know, least hospitable places on the whole of the planet, it must be very challenging for you. What are some of the, I don't know, physical barriers, if you like, to being able to do your work when you're, I don't know, halfway up Mount Everest, for example?
I mean, the biggest worry I've got, I mean, apart from the fact that obviously when I get there, I ask people to write their stories and no one will write anything. The biggest worry I've got is about the altitude and altitude sickness. But I guess I'll just have to take a lot of care when I go up, and I hope to be working with a Nepalese artist as well, and also having Nepalese people in support. So I think that will help greatly. In terms of being there at base camp, you know, I think there are a high degree of comforts there. You know, there are cookers there and mess tents and things like this. But obviously, this year at Everest Base Camp, there was an avalanche caused by the earthquake, and I think about 20 people were killed. So it's not without its dangers and difficulties. And of course, for me, I've probably got to try and resist the temptation to go higher at the mountain. And for that, I'm not massively well-equipped at the moment, although I have done some mountaineering and ice climbing in the past, but long-distant past.
Oh, well, at least you've got a bit of experience. Let me just ask you finally, Derek. A lot of people say, well, look, you know, one of the problems on Everest is that it's overexposed. Too many visitors, people who maybe don't care about the local community, the local people. Is part of what you're going to want to express in your work representative of the people of Nepal, for example, and showing, you know, that this isn't just a sort of a tourist trap. It's something very different from that.
Yeah, I mean, very much. And I think there is a contradiction at Everest Base Camp that I want to explore through this particular project. And obviously, you know, we all think about ambition and sports tourists and people paying thousands of pounds to climb Everest. But I also want to look at the Nepalese side very much, particularly post-earthquake. But, you know, Nepalese people make a living there, but yet it's a mountain goddess to them. And there's a queer juxtaposition there, I think, which must be a challenge. But also the issues about conservation and trashing the place and melting glaciers. And I think the triangle between spirituality, conservation and ambition is a space that I want to explore.
Fantastic. Well, good luck with your project. That's the Everest-bound artist Derek Ellen in Cumbria. Derek, thanks for being with us on the programme. Thanks to our producer Emily Elias, the research team Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Clara Strung, and our studio manager Wei Dong Lin. We're back at the same time tomorrow. Goodbye.
You've been listening to the UK and World News Channel on Orpio, powered by Audioboom.